This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, the New York for Palestine Coalition rally at Grand Central Station.
Mobilizing in defense of all the Palestinian children currently being detained by the settler Zionist state and demanding their release. But first, the recent provocative, sinister maneuvers by the Trump regime and Israel's far-right Likud party and how they have exacerbated the long-standing and ever-deepening crisis for Palestinian self-determination and the humanitarian tolls in the occupied territories. And we are delighted to have with us Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University, the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the occupied territories, and the author co-author of 20 books, including Chaos and Counter-Revolution, After the Arab Spring, and it is a pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Falk.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm almost always overwhelmed by the injustices heaved at the Palestinian heart, at the Palestinian homeland, by the forces in the United States. And I wonder if you can give us your thoughts on the recent provocative actions of the Trump administration and how important you think they are and their actual significance within a historic context. And that's a big task, but you're always up to it.
I was just thinking it was a big task. But first of all, on a fundamental level, there is a certain continuity between the Trump administration's approach and the approach of earlier presidents, which has been fundamentally supportive of Israel's expansionist policies and its oppressive administration of the occupied territories. It has altered in tone and in some ways given a green light to the more extremist vision of greater Israel that exists in Israel as a result of Trump's way of addressing, one-sided way of addressing the problem. Prior presidents always made the effort to seem as though they wanted a solution that was a political compromise fair to both sides. Trump has more or less abandoned that surface kind of presentation. As I say, underneath that surface was always a pro-Israeli partisanship. But here, that partisanship during the Trump period has gone to such an extent that I think more conservative Israelis and strong Zionist supporters are now thinking it's possible for Israel to declare victory in the conflict and to incorporate as much of the West Bank as they wish to have. The only thing that restrains them is the so-called demographic bomb, that is, the fear that they couldn't pretend to be a democratic society if they incorporate so many Palestinians that the Jewish majority is jeopardized. So there is a change, perhaps, that is substantively important in the sense that there is no plausible ground for Palestinians to participate in the kind of diplomacy that the United States was sponsoring ever since the Oslo Accords back in 1992-93. And that, in a way, is not entirely bad because there was no real prospect that a fair peace could emerge from that diplomacy. And now the burden has shifted, I think, to governments other than the U.S., perhaps Europe, perhaps China, and civil society, which I think has been emboldened to be more militant in relation to the Palestinian agenda. Finally, I'd say that the experience of last month involving Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the Israeli capital was a very divisive move from the point of view of the international approach to the conflict, which itself was somewhat suspect because it relied on this two-state solution, which seemed more and more unattainable. But what the Trump initiative did was to repudiate the internationalist sense that there had to be a fair solution before the resolution of the future of Jerusalem could be agreed upon. And further, when that was ran up against so much opposition that the General Assembly proposed a resolution declaring Trump's initiative null and void, Ambassador Haley at the UN tried to intimidate governments by saying that the White House would be watching and that economic assistance would be jeopardized for any government that supported the resolution. And what ended up was a vote of, I think, 125-8, with those eight countries, aside from Israel and the U.S., consisting of small island republics in the Pacific and two Central American countries. Not one important country in the entire world, including the closest allies of the United States, France, UK, Japan, sided with the U.S. And so it was a geopolitical disaster in the sense that for no gain from the point of view of American interests, this kind of unfavorable, disruptive initiative took place that was pleasing to Israel, pleasing to Netanyahu, but of no help to either the cause of peace, the cause of stability in the Middle East, or even the rather objectionable effort of the Trump administration to escalate the confrontation with Iran.
Professor Falk, taking it one step further, as the Israelis then did or are doing, the Likud party went on record for the annexation of the settlements in the West Bank. And Netanyahu basically said, well, what does that do for the rest of the Palestinians in the West Bank? And he would say, well, we'll make a state minus out of that. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's part of this effort to not entirely abandon some kind of Palestinian entity emerging out of a very unfair peace process, and basically go along with a unilateralist approach that incrementally takes more and more of the West Bank and creates a ethnic transformation in Jerusalem, with the objective really of incorporating both Jerusalem and the West Bank in its most valuable character with respect to land and water into the state of Israel, and trying to forget that Gaza exists because of the concern with the incorporating too many Palestinians, which would undermine the already thin claim of Israel to be a democratic state.
What's been intermingled in all of this is relevant to a piece that you wrote not long ago, Why the Two-State Solution Refuses to Die a Natural Death. And you say that despite all appearances to the contrary, those in the West who do not want to join the premature and ill-considered Israeli Victory Party are clinging firmly to the two-state solution amidst calls to renew direct diplomatic negotiations between the parties so as to reach, in the extravagant language of Donald Trump, the ultimate deal. Can you direct your attention to the issue of the two-state solution, or what you put out in many pieces, is aren't we better devoting ourselves to the nature of apartheid, Israeli style, as opposed to reviving a kind of Oslo-style peace process?
You well summarized my basic position, which is if you are genuinely interested in peace between the two peoples, the first step to take is to end these structures of subjugation that are directed at the Palestinian people as a whole, and which Virginia Tilley and I, in a study sponsored by the UN, concluded constitute a form of apartheid that is a crime under international law. And what I believe is the case is that until you eliminate or make a commitment to eliminate these ways of oppressing the Palestinian people as a whole, and that would include the refugees and those that are in involuntary exile, as well as those living under occupation or living as second-class citizens in Israel itself, until you make a commitment to the equality of the two peoples, there is no way of achieving a fair compromise. And Israel has done its best to make even the possibility of that fair compromise in terms of a Palestinian state non-viable. After the 67 war, they increased the allocation of territory to themselves from 55%, which the UN had agreed upon back in 47, and 78%. The Palestinians actually accepted that 78% as the basis of a really very pro-Israeli territorial compromise, but then Israel showed no interest in that and instead expanded their territorial reach into the 22% that was left to Palestine by establishing a couple hundred settlements with now, if you count Jerusalem, as many as 600,000 or 700,000 Israeli settlers. There's no possibility of having a viable Palestinian state without the elimination of the settlements, and there's no possibility of eliminating the settlements without having a civil war in Israel. So in my view, that notion that it is possible to negotiate diplomatically a viable, independent Palestinian state is just a illusion, because the international community doesn't want to give up on the Palestinians. At the same time, they can't challenge Israel in a more direct way. And so that it creates a very bad situation. But I do believe, as in the case of South Africa, that the first step is to admit or acknowledge that a system of subjugation based on race or ethnicity is unacceptable and must be dissolved as a precondition for a peaceful coexistence between ethnically distinct peoples. That's what happened in South Africa. They released Nelson Mandela, and they agreed to a constitutional transition that gave Africans an equal vote with the white Afrikaners and British settlers. And that was all done in a way that said, we recognize that the only way to have a transition to a sustainable peace is to get rid of apartheid. And I'm saying the same thing more or less applies to Israel, despite the differences in their situation, their history, their worldview, their geopolitical connections. There are important differences. But in this fundamental issue, do you want peace? In both instances, if your answer is yes, you have to get rid of this ethnic subjugation. And that probably means you have to give up the claim that Israel is the exclusive state of the Jewish people. It has to be a state within which there can be a homeland for Jews and a sanctuary for Jews, but you can't have a right of return for just Jews, but not Palestinians who had lived on the land for generations. That just won't be acceptable, and it will eventually flare up in some kind of political eruption.
Well, do you think on the basis of that, the Palestinians will change tactics and demand citizenship in a new state, whatever you call it, Israel or Palestine or whatever, and demand full citizenship, and that is a one-state solution?
That is one alternative that's been increasingly discussed. In other words, there is, in effect, since 1967 and the occupation, a de facto one state. But the Palestinians, other than the minority in Israel, pre-67 Israel, the rest of the Palestinians are living in a condition of rightlessness. So the position of some liberal Zionists and some people that see no other solution is to say, let's accept the reality of Israel's domination of the whole of Palestine, but demand that Palestinians be given equal rights within that territory. But the problem with that is twofold. One is that it requires the Palestinians to abandon the dream of their own national homeland within their own place of residence for generations. And secondly, it rubs up against the Israeli anxiety about a Palestinian majority population challenging control of the state, a unified state. And so the thinking that dominates Israel is a one-state solution with some kind of qualified participation by the Palestinians over a long-term period. And there's no likelihood that any Palestinian leadership that has any popular base could accept such an arrangement.
And we're speaking with Richard Falk. And one of the questions that I wanted to raise was the issue of the United Nations and why it matters, of course, that it is subject to the also outrageous slings and arrows of the Trump administration. But why does it matter, and why does it matter even for the Palestinians?
Yeah, that's a very important question, Mimi. And I think that it matters because symbolic issues matter in international life. And the struggle for the legitimacy of Palestinian grievances is fought out within the UN. The UN lacks the capacity to modify behavior unless it has the support of the geopolitical actors in the world. I mean, the UN can be very effective, sometimes too effective, as it was in relation, let's say, to Libya in 2011, because the geopolitical forces backed the claim being made in the UN. But so long as the U.S. blocks effective action in support of U.N. policy recommendations, there is no way of implementing these U.N. resolutions. But it is a signal to a civil society and to governments that are so inclined that it would be legitimate for them to take action in opposition to what Israel is doing. What I'm really saying is that there are hot wars and there are legitimacy wars. And the legitimacy war is being fought out at the UN and is being won by the Palestinians. Their challenge, of course, is to find ways to transform that kind of UN vote that they received in the General Assembly a couple of weeks ago into something that has political traction. And that remains to be seen, whether the Palestinian solidarity movement has grown sufficiently so that that kind of implementation in international society can happen despite the inability of the UN to do very much beyond these symbolic gestures.
I never can think of anybody better to speak to on this seemingly intractable dilemma, but for us, the dilemma really being to support the Palestinian struggle for liberation and to mobilize in defense of all of the Palestinian people. We have been speaking to Professor Richard Falk, who...
Thank you, Mimi, for your gracious words, and it's always a pleasure for me to be having the conversation with you.
But the pleasure is indeed all ours. And Professor Falk is the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the Occupied Territories and author of numerous books and a deep, abiding friend and advocate of Palestinian self-determination and for the Palestinian people. Professor Falk, our pleasure entirely.
Thank you, Mimi. Take care. Call me Richard.
Will do. And with that, we are going to go straight to the New York for Palestinian Coalition rally at Grand Central Station. It was both great fun to see how people commanded the space, took over the environment towards the end of supporting the Palestinian people, and with a specific emphasis on the issue of youth who were arrested, and that is Ahed Tamimi, a 16-year-old who has been arrested, is being held by the Israeli Defense Forces, and we want her released now. So let's go to Grand Central Station.
From Palestine to Mexico!
From Palestine to Mexico!
All the walls have got to go!
All the walls have got to go!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
We are gathered here today to demand the release of Palestinian child activist Ahed Tamimi from Israeli Zionist dungeon! Ahed Tamimi is a 16-year-old Palestinian girl from the village of Nabi Saleh, a village known for resisting increasing Israeli encroachment on their land. Ever since she was a child, she had to face Israeli soldiers coming onto her land, taking her father, imprisoning her father, imprisoning her family members, harassing them, beating them, shooting them. You know, before Ahed was actually taken by Israel, and because of the slap heard around the world, people don't know that the reason she slapped him is because right before that, they shot her 14-year-old cousin in the face and put him in a medically induced coma for his injuries. That's the background of that slap. It didn't come from nowhere.
Amen.
It came from a place of resistance.
Amen.
When Israeli soldiers came onto her land and shot her family members.
Amen.
And then tried to enter her home. This is not assault. This is self-defense. The same type of self-defense that Palestinians have been engaging in ever since 1948, when their land was illegally stolen by Israel. The Tamimi family is being severely targeted now because they are a symbol of resistance. Because they continue to stand up in the face of Israeli oppression, even when they've been oppressed and subjugated time and time again. Ahed Tamimi's father is also an activist, and he actually spent 3 years in Israeli jail without trial, without even a charge, in administrative detention, because they can do that. Now, they're trying to scapegoat our children, our people, our communities. But if someone were to come to your home, take your father and throw him in jail, and shoot your 14-year-old cousin in the face, and consistently target your family, and this is all you've seen growing up, What would you do? What kind of person wouldn't resist this? Wouldn't stand up to this unfair treatment? Ahad Tamimi's case is not an isolated case. Israel regularly targets, harasses, and abuses Palestinian children, especially when they are part of the resistance, because they want to crush their morale and spirit from a young age. And they want to send a message to the rest of Palestinian society, telling them, do not participate in similar things. Do not stand up for your family. Do not stand up for your land. Because if you do, we'll throw you in jail just like we did to her. But are we going to let them do that?
No!
Are we going to let them do that?
No!
Every single time, they so much as touch a hair on the head of one of our children. We need to be out here making the loudest possible noise that we can. We need to let Israel know that people are watching, that people won't stand for it. And that's why we're here today, to not only condemn Israel's atrocities against the Palestinian people and Ahad Tamimi, but stand for resistance in all aspects of Palestinian society in whatever shape or form it takes. We're also here to educate you, because there's a lot of misinformation going about this case, and if enough people knew what was going on with Ahad Tamimi, this crowd would be all of Grand Central Terminal. Every single person would join with us, because any person that knows the truth about the Palestinian struggle stands on the right side of history. Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Ahad Tamimi!
Free, free
Ahad Tamimi!
Free, free
Ahad Tamimi! Free, free Ahad Tamimi! We will be reading out 10 facts about the Tamimi case to educate you in this rally here, so that we are able to take what we learned outside of the noise that we make today and make sure that everyone we know, everyone that's in our mind, knows about Ahad Tamimi's case. Because we can't rest and we can't stop putting pressure on Israel until they release her and until they think twice about touching one of our children ever again.
And that's what we intend to do, free Ahad Tamimi and her cousin, Nariman Tamimi, and all of the child prisoners being held by the Israeli Defense Forces in occupied Palestine. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.